This is Connected Nation, a podcast focused on all things broadband. From closing the digital divide to improving your internet speeds, we talk technology topics that impact all of us, our families, and our communities. On today's podcast, we explore the important work being done by the Black Churches for Broadband Coalition. Learn how the group is working to better connect Black communities, what resources each of us can share to help others, and why the coalition calls the need for universal broadband a civil rights issue. I'm Jessica Denson, and this is Connected Nation. I'm Jessica Denson, and today we're talking with Dr. Fallon Wilson, Vice President of Policy for the National Multicultural Media, Telecom, and Internet Council, the group leading the Black Churches for Broadband Coalition. Welcome, Dr. Wilson.
Thank you for having me, Connected Nation. I'm so happy to talk with you today.
We are excited to talk with you as well. Before we dive into what the coalition is doing in regard to internet access among Black communities, share a little bit about what the Multicultural Media, Telecom, and Internet Council is and your role within the group. That's a big mouthful.
I feel like we have the longest name, but it has such a long history, so hence the long name. For the last 36 years, the Multicultural Media, Telecom, and Internet Council, which everybody in the D.C. Beltway refers to lovingly as MMMTC, has been advocating for an inclusive environment for communities of color as it relates to broadcasting, telecommunications, innovation, and internet. And so it is a historical legacy civil rights organization that pretty much making sure that Black and brown people in this country can have access and primarily operates within a policy space and with public comments and filings to ensure that, you know, good actors stay good actors, bad actors are held accountable, and we can build a bright future for people of color in this country. I am their newest vice president of policy. I've been with them now a year and a month, which is really exciting because I have the opportunity to work with a cross-section of leaders who have such in-depth relationships and histories with working on these historical problems that now have new iterations. And so that is my role, and I get to do it alongside a great team of individuals who understand the politics and the policies of DC as it relates to advocating for communities of color within this space.
And do you find that that's really important to have a voice at that level so that there is some representation to ensure equal access and all of those things in all of these forms of media?
Yes. I think it is important that I honestly, MMTC should be a household name for the amount of great work that it's done to support Black and brown communities over the last 36 years. But primarily because they operate in the policy space, they are not necessarily like, to your point, the very long name, it's not a kitchen table conversation like the NAACP or the National Urban League and other amazing civil rights organizations because of the heavy policy and technical space we find ourselves in. I think having these national organizations and civil rights tech organizations, both us as historical, but also some of the newer ones that are coming up like Color of Change and others, doing this amazing work at the national level ensures that, you know, the local folks on the ground have like a ladder up into these large national, really big conversations, mainly now about digital inclusion, but of course, across many other platforms as it relates to this new automated world that's being built. So they are essential to the fabric of like a democratic institution that is supporting the building of a new digital age.
And just to, we are going to move on to Black Churches for Broadband in just a moment, but just okay. To give our listeners an example or an understanding of what are some challenges people of color or communities of color face when it comes to equal access on that level?
I mean, on one level, we can talk about broadcasting and the number of licensings that go to Black and brown leaders in that space. We can also talk about the number of Black and brown contractors that get access to federal dollars to actually lay fiber and those types of things. We can even talk about the number of black and brown people within tech companies, which has averaging 4 to 6% of their population are people of color, and in a very negligible amount if we're specifically talking about African-American people. And so when you look around in this digital age and in this new tech world that we're building, black and brown people suffer multiple types of digital discriminations that are affecting their abilities to be fully like participatory and thought leaders and community builders in this new automated age that I think we find ourselves in. And so discrimination looks like access to contracts, access to work, access to being paid what you're supposed to be paid. And on a very local level, and maybe even on a hyper like school level, having access to computer science in your public high school, because, you know, we underfund public education in this country. And so our students in public schools often don't get the genius of computer science teachers to help them onboard or on-ramp or digitally upskill, right, for this new work economy. And so that's what discrimination looks like. And as a form of digital discrimination.
So it's very important for us to be intentional in this moment of time, especially as things change and grow. And
right.
I would agree. I would applaud that. And I think that all of us at Connected Nation, we're very in tune to the importance of digital equity and digital inclusion. So that's why I asked that question. I really wanted people to understand that this is at all levels, even though you do work at the federal level. I understand that. Okay, so let's move on to the Black Churches for Broadband website. It says it's powered by the coalition. Why did MMTC decide to organize such a coalition for broadband advocacy?
MMTC, once again, is well known for being a policy shop, like filing briefs, doing incredible research on these disparities and how they emanate in broadcasting, telecommunication, in various other domains where we find like this digital age, like planting itself. I believe that our leadership, Robert Branson, who is a long time like supporter of the FCC and a longtime worker in this space, understood the need to try to operationalize our policy work, because it's an opportunity for us to address the digital divide in a more direct service type of way, in addition to our public filings and comments. I think he, like our other leadership and myself, just saw how devastating the pandemic had been for Black people and brown people in this country, that not to move beyond just filings just seemed like we were not meeting our mission and our mandate. And then also because we also know and believe in the power of African-American institutions, whether we're talking about historically Black colleges or universities or African-American churches, that they are like prime like locations to organize large bodies of Black people toward equitable and social justice issues. So both as an ethical issue of how do you address this pandemic and its its demoralizing effects on Black people, right? But also, what are the institutions that operate within the Black tech ecosystem or within Black communities that we could really hone in and support educating them about these federal issues, specifically the emergency broadband benefit last summer, and so that they can begin advocating and enrolling their communities in this amazing initiative to really end the digital divide. So it's both our ethics and just also the practice of looking at venerable institutions that carry this type of engagement work locally.
And just to really drive that home, a sobering fact that was included on Black Churches for Broadband's website, it says that about 71% of Black families do not have broadband internet access at home, which, could you imagine, suddenly, just to try to help listeners understand, you have to telework. Suddenly your kids are trying to work right from home and they're trying to do it on a mobile device.
Right.
It's really the wrong side of the digital equity gap. And why do we see that so much, in your opinion, among Black families, among the Black community? Is it just an issue of affordability, or is it an issue of understanding? Is it a combination thereof?
I think it's all of the above. I think it's all of the above that causes the challenges, right? Mm-hmm. It is the cost of the internet, which is why was excited about the emergency broadband benefit, and now super excited about the affordable connectivity program. But it's also about adoption, right? People say, if you build it, they will come. That's not how it works when you think about the types of racial alienating structures that Black and brown people, or women, or other marginalized categories of people have to navigate in the world. So we have internet in our community, and we just assume people will use it, but it doesn't work that way, because people are navigating like many different things, like working full-time schedules and then having to figure out how to connect a modem to your cable box, to your TV, and then figuring out how to go through that process. So part of it is like the digital literacy piece of it. And the other part of it is, I don't think we have really translated to our many communities why of interest it should be for them. Not just simply saying, oh, the robots are coming and they're going to take your jobs. And so you need to learn this. You got to do it. I don't know if people rise to threats. I as a former educator and academician and professor, I don't think you motivate learning or the desire to learn through threats of not having, primarily because so many of the communities we're talking about have had to figure out how to navigate not having, right? And so I think you need to talk about it in a more affirmative space to say that you can make your dreams come true here. One of the failures of our digital inclusion advocacy work is not allowing Black and brown people and women in other categories where we don't see them as prevalently using technology. We don't give them the opportunity to dream and to have wonderment. They don't get to like just geek out and think about how Oculus Rift and metaverses work for them, because they can't afford the hardware. And also because we have not told them that this could be joyful. It's not just about work. And for communities who are overly worked, underly paid, it just creates a more complex narrative for how we should think about why people are not connecting to the internet when they do in fact have access to it because of the affordable connectivity program, and because there are many low cost options out there from companies and municipalities and all of those things, but people are still not using it. The question must fall back on us for how we engage and frame this narrative of why it's so important for you to be connected and using the internet. I hope that answered your question.
It did. It's very good. It was a huge question. I know. I sometimes ask those, just for our listeners' sake. And, the Affordable Connectivity Program is the more permanent program of the FCC that's going to offer $30 off a month of internet services and money off of a device. So definitely send people that way who are looking to gain access at a more affordable cost. The organization on their website, the Black Churches for Broadband Coalition, which I keep repeating because I want people to really understand that's what we're talking about, they note that, universal access is, quote, a civil rights issue. Mm-hmm. I would love to hear from your point of view. I just thought that was such a great way to put it. But I would love to hear from your point of view why that is.
It is what you said earlier. When the pandemic occurred, even though digital inclusion advocates like you and I have been doing this work for a very long time, we realized that without internet access, people could not get groceries delivered to them. They would have to go out. At that point, we didn't have vaccines, right? We didn't really have a good testing structure either, right? And so people had to navigate, who didn't have the means and the class privilege, how do I just get groceries for my family and ensure that I don't get or contract the actual virus, right? You saw it in the 13 million children, right, mm-hmm. who were completely chronically absent for all of 2020. And we could not identify nationally where those children went, right? Because they did not either sign on to the devices that were given, or they did not get the devices to begin with. You see it now in the, at least if we're talking about from the framework of African-American people, that almost 500,000 Black businesses closed during the pandemic, primarily because they could not transition and sign on, right, to this new digital e-commerce ways and strategies of being online. And so for me, when you think about like civil rights, your ability to be free, right? Mm-hmm. To be able to fully participate and have an active voice in your country or in your society, right? Without the threat of violence or discrimination, I think not having internet puts you in a place where violence can happen to you. And not in the traditional ways in which we have thought and operationalized civil rights in this country based on the history of white supremacy, but really thinking about what does it mean when many departments and government agencies are using your data to track you, but you don't have the internet to be able to access how they're tracking you, right? And so that creates a whole many challenges around data surveillance and hyper-surveillance of Black and brown communities, i.e. a civil rights issue and one that will forever grow as we become more of an automated and more, you know, more interconnected in the various systems that are pulling data to make decisions for communities.
Do you also think that having that access gives a voice that I have heard, and tell me if I've got this wrong or right, that having social media or having access to share your own point of view without it seeing it through someone else's lens. Like I try to get out of your way and let you explain and rather than me explain things, because seeing things through someone else's lens is not right. Truly necessarily reflective of you. And so I've heard that with social media, there's been this opening in within the Black community where they can, people in the Black community can finally right. say their point of view. Would you feel that's true?
Right. I think number one, as a person of color, I think Black people have always said what they have said. I think we've always had counter publics. There's a whole literature on that uh-huh. where Black people in particular in churches, which would be a counter public space to like the norm space of like American society, where we had our opinions and our thoughts and we freely acted as you know, embodied beings, embodied people. I do think that technology is another form or another iterative of what happens and what has been happening within Black homes and Black institutions is that social media has given us the ability to share voices and also to highlight discrimination, right, as it happens in life, right? And so the emergence of using smartphones to capture the beating of Black and brown bodies, right, or taking to Twitter or Black Twitter to denounce the Oscars for being so white and seeing the discrimination there. And so we have always had our voices. We have always had our counterpublics where we've had our voices. I just think technology is a different iterative of that. And I think we use it very effectively.
I would agree. And yeah, I didn't want to suggest that there wasn't a voice before, just that there was new platforms. Right. One interview that I did recently, because it is Black History Month, all February, he said that the internet has the potential to be a great equalizer. Do you see that as a possibility as well?
I mean, that is a grand statement. I would venture to say equalizer. What does that mean? Because I don't know, once again, that if you give the internet to everyone, once again, you build it, they come. It doesn't work that way. I think in order to have an equitable future for Black and brown people in this country and immigrant communities and undocumented communities, we have to attack the structural issues of like white supremacy on its head, mm-hmm. which in this new iterative, it does animate in the technologies that we have created or creating, right? But it's also in non-tech environments that create like intersecting barriers for Black and brown people and other marginalized communities to be fully engaged. So it has the potential to be the great equalizer. I'm pretty sure they said that about the printing press, but then they didn't think about how white supremacy would keep Black people from reading and engage. You see, I think we put a lot on like, because, you know, there's all these enlightenment ages and you'd be like, but there was still like oppression and enslavement and an indentured people. And so I don't know if technology unto itself is going to be the great equalizer, or it could be the great equalizer. I just think that it's probably, if I'm going to equalize the world, I really need to address like the systems of like oppression that keep people from just being free. That's how we equalize.
Completely understand what you're saying. I agree with you. I think it's a whole systematic thing. It's not one piece. And on that note, I did mention Black History Month. Why do you think it's so critical from your point of view, for us to continue to have this time of year that we can actually lift up Black culture and what's happening in the Black community, not just in the past, but currently?
And I want to also say just for the note to note it for your listening public, that Black Churches for Broadband was our campaign last summer, but we have a new iteration of it, and it's Black Churches for Digital Equity. So all the amazing conversation that we've had up until this point is really trying to frame a narrative that this is about equity, and this is about adoption, and this is about people being liberated and being able to make choices for themselves. And so thinking about like this historical month that we have to celebrate Black history, personally, I celebrate it every day of the year, but I do appreciate it that it's an actual like known experience of activities that both communities, companies, and government have gotten behind to be excited and to support the genius that really built this country, in addition to our First Nation people, right? I think it is important that we do take time and to identify within our organizations and our community those who are, you know, those Black folks, right, who are contributing to, you know, often by their bone, marrow, and sweat, a lot of sweat equity that we give to this country, is important to acknowledge them, if not add additional types of forms of covering and support so that they can continue to do the work. But I just want to say the point, yes, we started at Black Churches for Broadband, but our vision is much larger, and it's about equity and liberation as we move forward.
That brings me to my next question. What can all of us do to help with this mission, to take part, to increase its impact?
Well, I'm so happy you asked, Jessica. First and foremost, we are kicking off Black Churches for Digital Equity with our first public panel for the year on March 14th at 7 p.m. We're going to stream directly live to our Facebook account, and we will have some of our most known Black church leaders in conversation with Scott Woods at NTIA about how Black churches as legacy and also could be seen as anchor institutions, right, will lead these conversations across their states for digital equity. And I think the way you can help, because I know there'll be a lot of amazing digital inclusion advocates and public interest tech folks listening to this podcast, is that you can help support the narrative that when we need to broaden the scope of anchor institutions, right? We know that our libraries, our schools, and our hospitals do amazing work, and they do. But I think we really should have a conversation about faith-based nonprofits being designated in statute for the amazing work that they also do. I think we forget that before the internet was hot, you know, churches, mosques, and temples had computer labs, right, in the early 90s to help orient and train their congregations, like to retool them for work or to have an after school like tutorial program for the youth in their sanctuaries, right? And also, let's be clear, the intersection between like faith-based nonprofits and cultural communities is extremely salient, and also can help with some of our interest-driven framing for why people should think about this as part of their daily lives. So you can help me by supporting that type of conversation around supporting faith-based nonprofits and seeing them as anchor institutions as we do this work with Black Churches for Digital Equity.
Fantastic. I'm going to leave it there for now. I will include a link to the March 14th event in the description of the podcast.
Thank you so much.
I'll get that from you before we go. I really appreciate your time today, Dr. Fallon Wilson.
And I appreciate talking with you, Jessica.
Again, we've been talking with Dr. Fallon Wilson, Vice President of Policy for the National Multicultural Media, Telecom, and Internet Council. the group leading the Black Churches for Broadband Coalition, and as we just learned, the Black Churches for Digital Equity Coalition.
That is the new name.
Yeah. Yes. I'll include links to both organizations' websites in the description of this podcast. And a little programming note for you, looking ahead to our next podcast, we're going to continue our conversation with Dr. Wilson, who has lots of other great work she's been doing, and focus instead on the other work she's doing in tech and media to support Black voices and families. And I hope you'll join us for that. I'm Jessica Denson. Thanks for listening to Connected Nation. If you like our show and want to know more about us, head to connectednation.org or look for the latest episodes of Connected Nation on iTunes, iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts, Pandora, and other major podcast platforms.